The second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota v. Elijah Page. For the appellant, Elijah Page, we have John Murphy, an attorney from Rapid City, and Mr. Michael Butler, an attorney from Sioux Falls. My understanding is that during the 35-minute opening presentation that Mr. Murphy will speak for 18 minutes and then Mr. Butler for 17, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. And then Mr. Campbell, who represents the State of South Dakota as an Assistant Attorney General, you will have 35 minutes. And then on the rebuttal, first Mr. Murphy for 7 minutes and then Mr. Butler for 8. All right. And counsel, if you wish to take a water glass up, it's extended time once again, and please feel free to do so. With that, Mr. Murphy, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am going to spend my allotted minutes discussing Section 3 of Mr. Page's brief, which addresses the proportionality among co-defendants that was raised when this court issued its order of remand. And that issue involves a comparison among the defendants as to the role they played in the offense, the mitigation evidence that was presented, the aggravating factors that were presented, with the purpose in mind of determining whether real, meaningful, and substantial circumstances exist, or substantial differences exist, that warrant the imposition of a death sentence in Mr. Page's case and the imposition of a life sentence in Mr. Hoadley's case. We have to determine whether those substantial, meaningful distinctions exist, because if we do not assess co-defendants' proportionality, this would allow for a system where arbitrary sentencing occurred among capital defendants.
What is the test in that respect? Is it if they're substantially similar, or can you tell me what the test is?
Well, under 27A or 23A, 27A, 12, and 13, this court is supposed to assess, when it does its general proportionality review, whether the cases are similar. And so in reading Garber and Bonner, it appears that it is the test is whether the defendant has shown that the defendant's role in relation to his co-defendant's role was similar, thus warranting imposition of equal sentences. Now, my understanding of the order of remand was that this court asked Judge Johnson to conduct this meaningful review, this comparison, on not just what they did during the crime, but the mitigation evidence and the aggravating circumstances as well. It was not this court's intention to have the judge go back and select assertions in the record that tended to make Elijah Page look like he was worse of an individual than Mr. Hoadley. But it appears when we look at the trial court's findings of fact, that's what happened. That the trial court judge went back with the eye, and it may have been unintentional. We have to acknowledge this is not something that happens on a daily basis in trial courts in this state. We look at the Florida decisions where this is a regular procedure, but in this case, the trial court judge was acting in a way that he probably has never done before and didn't have much guidance. But he went back and selected assertions that seemed to support his initial sentence. When I said that the scope of review, or the way we should look at comparing these defendants, that this should be based on real, meaningful, and substantial facts, what I mean by that is when we're talking about facts that are going to be utilized to determine whether one person gets life and one person gets death, we better be sure that what we're talking about are, in fact, facts. They have to be meaningful, they have to apply to the crime itself, and they have to be substantial in the sense that they set people apart into different categories. And we've looked at the cases that, many cases cited both by the state and the defense that in other jurisdictions where they look at who's the prime mover versus the clear follower. Who was the lookout person versus the guy who goes into the convenience mart and shoots the cashier. Those are the substantial differences. I watched the previous argument and saw the Attorney General's office argue that we had to show that the defendants were identical. That's clearly not the standard under the court's general proportionality review, and it certainly is not the standard set forth in Garber or Bonner. When we start the analysis of this case, let's start from assessing what we really know to be true about the defendants. what we know about the defendants as a matter of fact, we aren't, they're not subject to dispute. They're the same age. They were charged with the exact same crimes. The same aggravating circumstances were alleged against them. They were convicted of the same offenses. The same aggravating circumstances were found beyond a reasonable doubt. The state treated them the same way, and that the state offered neither of them a plea bargain. The state's view of them was the same in their pronouncements to the trial court. And I referenced the lengthy section of our brief where we cite numerous examples where the state's attorney argued repeatedly to the Hoadley jury that these three defendants were equal, they were actively involved in every aspect of the crime, and the state's attorney even went so far to say it was disingenuous for Hoadley's defense counsel to try to make him look lesser culpable.
You know, that brings up an interesting question. Should the state's oral argument, which is argument, in the Hoadley case, be used as substantive evidence for us to consider in making a decision in this case? We tell juries every day that they're not to consider the argument of counsel as evidence.
Well, it goes directly to the view that the state treated these defendants the same, and presuming that the state was intimately familiar with the record, that their conclusions about the state of the record should carry weight. And it also goes to this idea that if the state is arguing inconsistent theories, saying in one case they're the same and now coming before this court and saying they're dramatically different, that encourages, that's actually an invitation to sentence people in an arbitrary manner. And the state should not be doing that. The state should not be arguing the same evidence in one tribunal and then taking an inconsistent position, because that promotes...
That may be, but still, my question is, may we consider counsel's argument as substantive evidence in making a decision on the merits?
I believe you should. And the reason is because that argument was a reflection based in the record of what the defendant's culpability was. So you start certainly at the statements of the defendant, but the state's characterization of those very statements, showing that even the inferences drawn from the evidence shows equal culpability, should carry some weight. Now, other factors that show the similarities. The 404B evidence presented regarding these defendants was very similar in kind, but in fairness, if you look at this record, the 404B evidence presented against Daryl Hoadley was much worse than that presented against Elijah Page. If we reference the arguments previously made, we know Daryl Hoadley slit a girl's throat in a park, I believe she was 14, over a pot pipe, threatened to kill his girlfriend, and assaulted his mother. Counterbalancing that on Elijah Page's case is this relatively absurd Scott Hunter incident. So we balance the 404B. We also balance the mitigation. We have to look, and I believe Justice Meyerhenny referenced the mitigation evidence. Any fair reading of the records comparing Hoadley to Page shows that the amount of mitigation evidence presented on Page's behalf was overwhelming compared to Hoadley. In fact, the trial court judge concluded at the end of the hearing that he wouldn't want to see a dog treated as poorly as Elijah Page was as a kid. We had witnesses from Kansas and from all over who had talked about Elijah Page being used as a shield by his father during a drug deal that had gone wrong, that he was sexually abused for years. And then all of his rehabilitative efforts, involving himself with his church group, setting his own curfews.
Well, now, in the previous argument, we were told that a good upbringing in childhood should favor leniency, and you're arguing exactly the opposite, that bad childhood should favor leniency.
Well, I saw the previous argument, at least this AG's position, was that if you had a good upbringing, that you shouldn't, you don't have anything to excuse your present misbehavior. And that's, I think, was the way it was supposed to be presented. In Mr. Page's case, certainly his horrible upbringing, raised in a house full of drugs, prostitution, and everything else, showed that he never had the guidance that he should have had as a young man. We also can glean from the record generally that all three of these individuals were engaged in generally the same conduct. Now, that's what we know. And if we look at those things that we can say we know, which are the kind of things that appear to be what we're looking for in decisions like Bonner and Garber, things that we can say, age, criminal record, those kind of things, those show equal culpability, similarity of position, similarity of role. Now we have to look at the other side. what don't we know? And I suggest to this court, what we don't know is far greater than what we do know, and what we don't know for sure, what aren't the real facts, are what the trial court relied upon in issuing its findings of fact justifying the death sentence. Almost all of the evidence relied upon by Judge Johnson came from the defendant's statements. Mind you, none of these defendants ever testified. None of their statements were ever subject to cross-examination. They were never subject to a meaningful credibility side-by-side review. Even if Judge Johnson sat on all three cases, he sat on cases where he watched videotapes of self-serving statements by defendants. He didn't have the opportunity to see Page get on the stand, Hoadley get on the stand, Piper get on the stand, get cross-examined and say, I have a meaningful basis to believe one and not the others. He watched videotapes. And these were self-serving statements. They were all trying to curry favor. In fact, Hoadley's statement starts out by him saying he's hoping to get a probationary sentence and not go to prison if he tells the cops his side of the story. Also, all of these statements changed over time. Each defendant's successive statements and their allocutions to the court and whatnot changed. And when you look at the statements together, they're contradictory, they're inconsistent, and they're ambiguous. If we are here today to decide life and death, how can we brush past all the things we know that show they were treated the same and base our decision on ambiguous and misleading and contradictory statements that we can't say with any certainty that we really know contain any kernel of the truth? Justice Sinner, I'm going to use some examples from the record, not many because they've been gone over before, but you asked about the issue of who stole the gun. This was an issue that the trial court said distinguished Page from Hoadley. Well, the only reference, or there's very few references to who actually stole the gun, in Exhibit 120F, pages 35 and 36, a law enforcement officer, I believe Agent West, asked Mr. Page, what did Daryl and Piper tell you? And Elijah Page said, and they said, somehow I got the gun out of his house, and it goes on. Later in that same statement, page 158, he says he really had no idea how he got the gun. And in his change of plea hearing at page 25, he says, I recall definitively Piper telling me he stole it out of Dottie Pogue's bedroom, and he gave it to me. So first off, do we know, when the judge says Page stole the gun, is that a real fact? No, it's a take, or it's one possible interpretation of the fact. Is it meaningful? Mind you, the gun was unloaded, it was used during the robbery, it had nothing to do with the murder. And then if we look at whether this fact, in and of itself, or even in an aggregate, contributes to finding a substantial difference to the defendants, among the defendants, how can we balance that fact with the fact that Daryl Hoadley provided the murder weapon, aggressively stabbed Chester Allen Pogue, mocked Elijah Page for not stabbing him hard enough? That kind of comparison was never done. Instead, the trial court judge selected a fact or an assertion of fact or his take on a fact and said that justifies disparate sentences, grossly disparate sentences. Another fact in a similar vein, the trial court judge found that Page drowned Mr. Pogue. Well, here's where, perhaps going back to your question, Justice Sinner, about the state's arguments. In the briefs submitted for this case at page 11, the state said that Hoadley and Page jointly drowned Mr. Pogue. So then we're back to joint culpability or equal culpability as opposed to the way the trial court determined it. At the Hoadley trial, the state said that Hoadley and Piper, not Page, drowned Mr. Pogue. And in Hoadley's own statement, he said it was he and Piper, not Page. So here, wherever we go in the file, we can find a different version of the events. And really what it boils down to is there's no difference among the defendants in any meaningful way. This is not the kind of difference that you would find between a lookout and the gunman, trigger man and the distractor, any of those type of roles. And we've referred to many Florida cases that have decided this issue on that kind of prime mover versus subordinate type distinction. The last example I would say is I'd identify as finding of fact 30, where the trial court judge said that Mr. Page stabbed Mr. Pogue first. Well, we can't determine whether that's a real fact from this record. In Hoadley's statement, pages 32 to 35, he indicates that it was Piper Okay, so now we have the two defendants at issue in this appeal saying contrary things. And then again, is that meaningful? Was there a meaningful comparison? We're talking about relative culpability. Was there a meaningful comparison? And how is that accomplished when we know that Hoadley provided the knife, Hoadley mocked Page for not doing the stabbing in a real manner, and then he took the knife by himself, went down there, and did something far worse, at least according to his own statement, of stabbing him much harder in the throat after he's mocked Eli Page for not doing it hard enough. The conclusion we can draw from that, both of these gentlemen had a role in playing in the stabbing of Chester Allen Pope. We can't go any further than that. We're back to relatively equal culpability.
Refresh my recollection on the second stab wound, the one to the brain. Who administered that?
Well, if depending on the record, it appears Mr. Piper. That there's conflicting statements on that, but it appeared, at least from the overall scheme, that Mr. Piper stabbed him in the head. That Mr. Page and Mr. Hoadley, Mr. Page stabbed him in the neck on the side, and then Mr. Hoadley said, that's not even a serious wound, took the knife and went down there and stabbed him in the front of the throat. So, but, and then there now we have between the three defendants, all of them, according to one version of events, playing a part in the stabbing of Chester Allen Pope. Again, back to equal culpability, looking at the record, relatively equal 404B, relatively equal mitigation. We are at a playing field that is relatively level. The purpose of showing why the findings of fact are flawed is not to identify that somewhere in the record the judge might have seen things the wrong way or not had the benefit of combing through the record thoroughly enough. It's really a matter of identifying a problem with the approach. Rather than a micro-analysis...
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. The approach should have been the big picture, pulling back and saying, are there overarching qualitative distinctions that we can draw on known facts that show substantially different roles or substantially different culpability? When we look at what we know about this case, we cannot find that those distinctions. When we look at what we don't know, we see there's a lot of confusion, but even taken at its best, all it really reflects is equal culpability. If we're going to avoid arbitrary sentencing in a death penalty case, we have to base our decisions on real meaningful issues, real meaningful facts, and draw our conclusions from those. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mm-hmm. Mr. Butler, you have 17 minutes, sir.
It's not my intention to spend much time, if any, on the issue about proportionality, but having listened and having worked on the case and the brief, I feel obliged to make a couple observations. As I've listened to the attorneys for the state, for Mr. Piper, and now my co-counsel, Mr. Murphy, and we'll soon listen to the state again, the question that I keep asking myself as I read the record and I read the findings is it reliable? Is what the judge said here something I can rely on in order to base a decision that one person lives and one doesn't? Reliability isn't my idea. It's rooted in any number of U.S. Supreme Court decisions that says when it comes to inflicting capital punishment, one of the touchstone principles is that evidence, findings, and decisions must be reliable. Is it reliable to say that, well, one young man told somebody in the jail he felt bad, so therefore I find remorse? And yet in those same findings, he may have said he felt bad. I don't know whether I'd rely on it, but he may have said it. And yet that same judge merely makes an observation that Mr. Page pled guilty. Now, we all know, many of you have served as circuit judges, that acceptance of responsibility is in fact something to be taken into account. You might discount it, but you take it into account. The same finding that relies on a hearsay representation of acceptance of responsibility, remorse, gives no credit to a defendant who pled guilty and waived trial. I don't know that that's balanced. Is that a reliable assessment that we rest a difference on? What I ask, and then I'm going to move on to my other issue, is this, and we've laid it out in the brief. Ask yourself, is it something I'm going to rely upon? None of the three defendants were subjected to the traditional methods in which we attempt to ascertain what is credible and what is not. They didn't directly testify, nor were they subject to cross-examination. Many of the statements that came in were hearsay. Now, hearsay can be reliable. But you need to keep in mind, the judge in this case, although he was the judge at Piper and Page and sat at Holdley, never made fact findings based on anybody's testimony of these three defendants. All he heard was two factual basis statements given by Piper and Page, and Holdley's statement and allocution, which was unexamined. From that, could the court, and these statements were not broad, sweeping, encompassing. In fact, Holdley merely got up and said he felt really bad about getting caught up in this whole thing. He didn't get into the facts. So he doesn't even touch upon it. He's never examined about his role in this offense. And what should concern everyone in making the decision, is it appropriate that the other two be put to death because they're less responsible than Mr. Holdley, is you ask yourself, were any of Mr. Holdley's statements self-serving? Were Mr. Page's statements self-serving? Were Mr. Piper's? Perhaps so. Enough so that you're going to rely when each of them extends the finger of responsibility in the direction of the other. I'm going to pick Holdley. Why, Judge? You never heard him testify. Why are you believing him now? Are you believing him now because the Supreme Court sent this case back and said, is this the right thing to do? Execute Piper and Page and not Holdley. Why suddenly? What gave him credit? He didn't testify at the remand hearing. What made him credible? Justice Zinner, you asked this question about the state's arguments. And are they evidence? You know, I don't know that they are. But I'm not going to reduce it to mere sophistry for the sake that when an advocate gets in front of a jury and says, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Mr. Holdley is equally responsible. His attempts to diminish his responsibility should be rejected by each and every one of you, and you ought to impose the death penalty on him. And now the state comes up and says, there's some significant differences here upon which to rest these differentiated punishments, life and death. I was merely being an advocate at the time. I asked 12 citizens of this state to sentence this young man to death. Saw it as my job. I had to jack it up a little bit. Well, did you believe it when you said it? I suspect Mr. Fitzgerald did. I absolutely do. I don't think it was sophistry. I think Mr. Fitzgerald believed all three men deserved to be punished by being put to death. And for whatever reason, the jury decided not to do it. So now we're left with the question of saying, well, can we come up with a good enough reason now to uphold these grossly disparate punishments, life and death? And what are we going to get down to? Deciding between who we trust of the three, because they were the only ones there. And when you search the rest record in this case, don't merely ask, I think, whether you can find that somebody said something that makes the other one look worse, but ask yourself, would I rely upon it in allowing the penalty of death to go forward? Co-defendant proportionality, in my judgment, is not the same merely as the broad mandated review that you do in all death penalty cases. I think Bonner makes that clear. When Bonner was decided that 15 years was grossly disparate to zero time, it didn't compare all burglaries. It looked at those men involved in that case and asked, is this the right thing to do for these co-defendants based on what we know about their involvement in the crime? If 15 years is grossly disparate, life and death is grossly disparate. And we better have something more here than that one defendant made a more egregious characterization of the other's behavior. And it sounds more compelling, although it was never examined by anyone. I want to move on, make a rather dramatic turn from the facts to an issue that I have raised. It was raised in State v. Anderson, and I wish to address it now. And it's a broad-based challenge. It is my contention that as South Dakota Codified Law, Chapter 23A, 27A is written, that in each case in which a defendant either pleads guilty or is found guilty of first-degree murder. He must therefore be sentenced in accordance with the provisions of that chapter. And I'm going to demonstrate, I believe, why there is but a single conclusion, which is that those are mandatory sentencing provisions. Prosecutors can't bargain once there's a conviction. Judges can't decline to consider aggravating circumstances once there's a conviction. The legislature has created a classification, Class A felons, of which first-degree murder is one, of which my client entered a plea of guilty. Class A felons in South Dakota can receive one of two possible punishments, death or life, nothing less. Chapter 23A, 27A states that in all cases tried by a jury, a person is convicted of a Class A felony, a sentence of death shall not be imposed unless there's at least one finding of an aggravating circumstance. The entire chapter states that in the event of a conviction, in all cases, the judge, if it's a jury trial, shall resume the proceedings. He shall instruct the jury on the presence or absence of aggravating and mitigating evidence. Cases tried to the court shall. There is nothing in South Dakota law or in this chapter that allows the practice that's been going on in this state since 1979. Nothing. And the state has responded to my argument to say that shall, in this case, is apparent mandatory language. Shall doesn't mean shall when it comes to capital punishment. What is the crux of this argument? The crux of the argument is this. Our legislature decided that in all Class A felony cases, the sentence of life or death was going to be determined either by a judge or a jury. The issue of the death penalty could not be removed from consideration. It's not to be bargained with. And as an aside, I will note, when the state gets up and tells you that I'm suggesting an interference with their divine broad discretion in these cases, I'll ask the state to tell me in which case in our penal code, once there is a conviction obtained, is the state allowed to plea bargain with the penalty? That function belongs to the court as a result of what the legislature defines as the appropriate range of punishment. A prosecutor can't come in once a defendant pleads to burglary and says, Judge, no more than 5 years in this case. He can make a recommendation. He can put on aggravation. He doesn't need to put on aggravation. The role of the prosecution at the point of conviction is carefully established in the code. What the state has been doing since 1979 is telling some people charged with first-degree murder, if you plead, we won't consider the death penalty. And yet the chapter, if you go back and read it, doesn't allow them to do it. Now, is this something that I have simply come up with by reading it on my own? Absolutely not. State versus Clothier, 1986, our state Supreme Court, all five of them signed off on an opinion. In that case, there was an issue presented to the state Supreme Court concerning a defendant's complaint that the jury should have been told that he could get a life sentence if he was found guilty. The reason the defendant asked that is prior to trial, the state said, Judge, we're not asking for the death penalty in this case. Judge told the jury, death penalty is not an issue in this case. So it comes up on appeal, and the state Supreme Court, Justice Weiss writing for the majority at the time, talks specifically about the function of Chapter 23A, 27A in Class A felonies. It says, the procedure for ascertaining the punishment and possible imposition of the death penalty with or without a jury after a guilty verdict is provided by SDCL 23A, 27A. Nothing in this section authorizes the prosecutor or judge to determine the penalty prior to a guilty verdict. In a footnote, if the prosecutor has a recommendation, he may state it at the pre-sentence hearing provided by SDCL 23A 27A2. There may be situations where the state has no evidence of aggravating circumstances prescribed in SDCL 23A 27A1 that would justify the death penalty. But SDCL 23A-27A3 indicates the jury is to determine the mitigation or aggravation. Unless it's non-jury, then the judge conducts the pre-sentence hearing. Now the state responds and says, that's dicta. Don't pay attention to that. It wasn't material to the outcome of the case. You know, it might be dicta, but tell me why I'm wrong. Tell me why this is wrong. Tell me why all five members of the court signed off. I'm clearly telling prosecutors and judges there's a procedure set out by the legislature and you got to follow it. You can't pull the death penalty off the table. Can't bargain with it. If you want to bargain with the death penalty prior to the point of conviction, there is a way to do it. Now, the state says in its brief, under my interpretation or the Clothier interpretation, we're going to be forced to execute innocent people. We can't plea bargain anymore. And, you know, that's not even worthy of a bad first-year law student argument. You can plea bargain at any point in time. If I charge somebody's client with first-degree murder, I say, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will make a charging concession. He can plead to murder in the second degree and get life. If he wants to go to trial, he's going to face the possibility of the death penalty once he's convicted. I don't have control at the point of conviction. If you want to make a plea bargain, you make it before you go. But the way they've done it and the way we've done it since the beginning of capital punishment in this state is gone forward on first-degree murder and simply told the judge, told the defendant, you're not going to have to face capital punishment in this case. One thing I'm going to ask the court to do when you go back and consider this question in the face of a claim, it's all discretion, is to read the statutory, the scheme, 23A27A. Read it in connection with SDCL 2261. And tell me in there what I'm missing. Because the word shall appears, by my count, not less than 15 times in the six statutes that govern the sentencing process. And under the rules of statutory construction, well known, well adopted, I don't need to restate them now, but I will make a note, the state hasn't even addressed those in its brief. This court has said and said it over and over and over again, when the legislature uses the word shall, we assume they know what they're saying and mean what they're saying. State versus Nelson. A trial judge refuses to instruct a jury at the close of the evidence because he said I instructed him before the evidence. On appeal, this court noted it was plain error to fail to do so. The statute said you shall do it, judge. It didn't say it was harmless. In fact, the court made a note, even the most heinous crimes, there are certain requirements that are fundamental and they're absolute. And the court said we interpret the word shall as a mandatory directive conferring no discretion. This court assumes that statutes mean what they say and that the legislature has said what they mean. If that is a principle of law that applies in capital punishment cases, then there is but one inescapable conclusion. We've not followed our own law in this state. The very thing that caused every statute in this country to get struck down by the United States Supreme Court was the arbitrary nature in which capital punishment was inflicted. I'm not arguing here the way the legislature wrote the law is unconstitutional. I'm arguing here.
2 minutes, counsel.
I'm sorry.
2 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm arguing that if it's a mandatory procedure that creates a legislative classification and says this is how sentence is going to be determined in every case, and we don't do it, whether because the executive branch says I'm not going to do it, or whether because our state judiciary abdicates their responsibility to hold these hearings, the fact is then there is a denial, an absolute denial, of equal protection under the law. This court has said it. Equal protection of the law requires that the rights of every person must be governed by the same rule of law under similar circumstances. And in the administration of criminal justice, the imposition of different punishments or different degrees of punishment upon one than is imposed upon all for like offenses is a denial of such right. State v. Goodall, State v. King, State v. O'Connor. And if we have created a system for determining punishment and we're not following except when we feel like it, except when a prosecutor feels like it, that's arbitrary. That's a denial of equal protection. I go so far as to say that each and every person now sitting on death row has, as a result of this system, been denied equal protection under the law, the right to be sentenced the same way that everybody else similarly situated has their sentence determined. Finally, before my time runs out, that is why we don't have a proportionality pool that can be relied upon. Had we followed the mandatory procedures in this state, that proportionality pool would be huge because it would include every first-degree murder case since 1979 that should have been sentenced in accordance with the mandatory directives of our state law. I'm not attacking their right to charge. They can exercise all the discretion they do. Once there's a conviction, their authority to get up and say what the penalty is going to be or not going to be is gone. And that is true in every criminal conviction in this state. Capital punishment's no different. The legislature did it this way. That was their choice. The obligation of the courts is to enforce it. And the obligation at this point, I think, is to make that decision without regard to the consequences. A lot of money's been invested putting people on death row, and I understand that. And the public may not understand why we haven't been doing it in a fashion that's constitutional.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Campbell, you have 35 minutes, sir.
I address Mr. Butler's last point first. This court has looked at exactly this issue in Mueller and Rhines and come down and held against him. In each of those cases, he was citing Clothier. In each of these cases, he's arguing that prosecutorial discretion is unconstitutional. And this court rejected it both times for very good reasons. As was pointed out in Gregg v. Georgia, what he is asking for, no discretion, no plea bargains, is alien to our very sense of justice. What it is would make the death penalty completely unworkable. And that's, again, U.S. Supreme Court decisions that are quoted in this court's writings in Mueller and Rhines. This is just a rerun. It's the same old, same old. McCluskey v. Kemp, U.S. Supreme Court case cited in my brief, 1987, looked at Georgia. Georgia has virtually word for word the same statutes we do. And it said the discretion, notwithstanding that language, was constitutional. We are in the same position, and the same rule should hold. I mean, this court has looked at these issues. The United States Supreme Court has looked at these issues. It's not practical. It's not even just. Now, to go back to the proportionality issue, what I'm hearing today is that you can't trust statements like from interrogations or statements made to another prisoner because there's been no cross-examination. Where in the law of evidence is there that kind of rule? Statements made to other prisoners are routinely admitted in criminal trials all the time. It's perfectly legitimate just for the sentencing judge in this case. Now, what the judge did in order to protect the rights of each individual defendant here, of course, you know, it started out as one prosecution. It was split in order to be fair because there was fratricidal finger pointing. What the court did in each of the hearings that he undertook, and I think also in the proportionality remand findings, was he considered only the statements that a defendant made, the statements about himself, against himself. So if Piper is sliming Page, Judge Johnson did not hold that against Page. What Piper said only applied to Piper. He only looked at what Piper was saying about himself. Same thing with Page. And you look at Page, you look at that, at the interview he had with the police, and you have to have the creeping horrors. There's just no question about it.
How do you determine that from the findings, that that's what Judge Johnson did?
Well, it's actually in the record of each sentencing, and it's also in the findings. I believe it's in the findings. I know it's in the original sentencing that that's what he did. And in that regard, what's interesting here is until the lawyers got involved, nobody blamed Hoadley. Piper says, Page terrified me. Page, well, he sort of indicates that Piper is, you know, the instigator. But you look at what he says about what he does, and in almost every instance, you can look at that and determine he's acting on his own initiative. Now, the defense put in evidence from these experts, and you really should read the cross-examination of these experts. We have a mitigation expert. here is a timeline of his life. Did you put in anything that was unfavorable? No, we kept it all out. Well, is that fair? Experts, a trial court is not required to accept the testimony of an expert. And what do we hear here? Oh, we put in 500 pages of evidence. So, does weight make right now? Is it raw tonnage that decides whether you live or die? Of course not. The trial court could look at that evidence and make his own determinations. And the trial court looked at Page and found he's the one who pulls out the gun, points it at the victim, Allen. That starts off the whole thing. You go beyond that, when it comes to the knifing, everybody's kind of standing around. Page steps forward. Fuck it, nobody's gonna do it, I'll do it myself. The same thing again and again. Their expert says, well, there was a group dynamic and, well, on cross-examination, there are all these instances where Page is taking the initiative. Well, you see, that was because there was momentum. You don't have to accept that. You can look at this and decide that what really happened was every time the momentum started to slip, Page steps up to bat. We're not talking about a passive follower here. We're talking about someone who is equally, possibly even more, responsible than Piper. And Piper's a monster, too. You look at Page, he gets in to jail, and he's talking to the inmates. And of course, it's his own statement, so they're usable. It's not hearsay. And what's he saying? He's narrating his crime to the other prisoners as if he's going to McDonald's. There's no sympathy whatsoever for the victim, no sympathy for the victim's family. He goes beyond that. One of the prisoners he's talking to, he says, you better not talk, and tries to look menacing, according to Eric Aleo, who's one of the people in the jail with him. You have the letter written out, talking about anally raping one of the guards. And we're getting into Robert Leroy Anderson time here. I mean, these are serious, serious allegations. Well, they're not allegations, there's evidence of them. What Judge Johnson looked at this mass of documentation that the defense put in, and what did he conclude? You look at 96 and 97 when he's in this Ozanam facility, and their reports are really nice. He's a budding psychopath, not psychopath, sociopath. Sociopathic traits. No conscience, no remorse, and yet at the same time, he's sophisticated. Average intelligence, is IQ is 106 or something like that. And sure, he had a bad background. The court acknowledged that. The court made findings about that, acknowledged it at the original sentencing. But one of the most important things as far as Mr. Page goes on the remand in the Fines Factors Law is just how terrible he is as far as turning away opportunities for help. Now, we hear from the defense today about how, look at all the steps he took to improve himself. Read the Ozanam reports. He has no interest in helping himself. He's constantly running away. All he wants to do is go out on the street back into the drug culture. He has no interest in improving himself. I think at 96 they're saying that he is, they were forecasting increasingly dangerous and delinquent behavior. And that came home to roost here. What does he do when he comes up to South Dakota? Well, family was willing to take him in. He goes in with them and he says, well, maybe this one moment in life is in his favor. He goes in and apparently agrees to, you know, he agrees or asks for curfew. Well, a little while goes by, he doesn't like that, boom, he's out of there. Where does he choose to go? He goes back into the drug culture with Piper and Hope. Now, is this an indication of any rehabilitative prospects? I think what Judge Johnson was doing there was saying no.
But he doesn't really say that, does he? When I read the findings, I'm having difficulty seeing how, based upon his findings, where he weighed the mitigation and aggravation.
Well, I don't know if this is off the base, but I don't know that he should be weighing. Well, we're not a weighing state for mitigation and aggravation in the technical sense for death penalty purposes. Now, I think perhaps there might have been a better job done comparing each of the three in each of these various areas. Because I don't get the sense of a complete 360 degrees. It's more like 120 degrees. He's looking at, you know, certain areas and not others, and maybe that means, you know, like I said, the speculation as to what that meant. But what is the defense here really asking for regarding evidence? Well, you can't trust anything that's not subject to cross-examination. Well, how are you going to cross-examine someone who isn't going to testify? And can you force these people to testify? And if you do, can their stuff be used against them when they file their next habeas corpus down the road? If we throw out all the rules, which is what they're asking for, all of a sudden, rules of evidence don't count anymore. Nothing that's routinely put in a trial can be accepted or can be trusted. Well, there's a certain amount of distrust in everything. I admit that. But what makes this so completely different that the rules of evidence don't apply? And again, how are you going to make this system work? What kind of assessment? It almost seems to me like what they're asking for is, well, the only evidence that can come in is what's favorable to us. Oh, well, you can't pay any attention to this because there are conflicts in the evidence. That's true in almost every case. That's why you have trial courts, that's why you have juries. They're there to decide these facts. And it's a standard rule that if there's conflicting evidence, a trial court can't be clearly erroneous. So what does that say about their argument? Again, what the court decided was that looking at Page's actions in the crime itself, he was just about as much of an initiator as Piper was. And that was a distinguishing factor from Hope. Now, as far as whether regarding the proportionality of co-defendants, actually the fact that someone is the actual trigger man doesn't necessarily mean that they get the higher sentence. One of the cases that I cited in the brief from Georgia, Gillian Hall or something like that, in that you had a woman who came up with a plan to have her husband killed, and she had a friend of hers kill him. Part of her reasoning was, well, if I got a divorce, he tried to talk her into divorce. She said, no, if I get a divorce, I'll lose the insurance money. In that case, she got the death penalty. The shooter didn't. So it's not always just simple who fired the last shot, like the state's attorney, Mr. Fitzgerald, argued at the Hoadley trial. There's more to it than that. There are more gradations of responsibility. And as far as whether I can even talk about this, I don't think I am barred from talking about it. When you look at what was happening in the Hoadley trial, you have him claiming, I'm not guilty by reason of insanity. What happened was I was driven insane by his pain, and I didn't do anything up until the last moment, and then I put him out of his misery. Well, how credible is that? Okay. But you still don't have him initiating anything. He put the last torpedo into the Bismarck. Okay, fine. Well, what about the rest of the British Navy? They all pounded her too. And that's what the state was saying. You look at the lethal injuries. Piper did them, Page did them, and Hoadley did them. They all did that. They all certainly contributed to the lethal wounds that were inflicted to the neck and the head. That isn't where the division comes. The division comes in the leadership, in the initiating action, and Page is keeping everything rolling. And I respectfully suggest that that is a legitimate point of difference here. And I think Page's record of rejecting help from 1996 all the way up to months before this killing, rejecting anything just to go out and do his own thing regardless, is aggravating also.
What is the test we should apply for future cases here? When we have co-defendants, some who get life, some who get death. What is the test?
That's a difficult question, because I think under the Eighth Amendment, it doesn't require equal results. You could have a more serious defendant have a more serious defendant get the lesser sentence. That is possible under Eighth Amendment analysis. They say that while the U.S. Supreme Court has said that while equal results are intellectually satisfying, they're not necessary, which is a bit of a shock to me. I think the result might well be different under the statutory. But again, with the statutory analysis, you're still looking at abuse of discretion because of the sentencer's discretion in sentencing. And that discretion was referred to in both Mueller and Rhines. If it is discretion, that's a very high standard to pass. And you have one issue when you have, say, the same judge on three cases, like in the Barton case. In that one, this court said it's to the advantage of the defendant to have the same judge on all three cases, because he's the only one that's seen all of them and been able to assess them. He also has access to all the records, but again, the defense says, well, that doesn't mean anything because he hasn't seen them testify. But he's seen them every day in court. He's seen them during the sentencing proceedings or the change of plea where he's giving a factual basis. He can see who's evasive and who isn't. And he can judge their candor, their honesty, and the degree of their remorse. Here he found some with Hoadley, who seems not to have realized what was going on until he was actually in jail. You have Hoadley's defense counsel making a very good use of his young daughter as a sympathy angle. Is that an improper reason to see a difference here? These are not all the same people. And I don't think the judge was abused discretion in finding that there were significant differences here.
How do we factor in, though? We have an independent duty under the state statute to do our own proportionality analysis. Now, do we use the trial court's? How does the trial court's discretion factor into that? Aren't we required independently to look at each death sentence in South Dakota and see if they are similar?
An interesting aspect of that is that the trial court in the Hoadley trial said that the defense could not argue proportionality, that was for this court. How does that affect this? If the trial court is making findings of fact, conclusions of law would be to know. You get into the mixed question of fact and law, but the findings of fact, I think, are still entitled to some deference. Because again, as stated in Garten, he's the one who has seen all these people. He's seen the witnesses that are putting on this 500 pages of mitigation. He can judge how sound the scientists' methods are.
You know, but when we're looking at our, this, as I understand it, under the statutory requirement, the mandatory requirement, only we have jurisdiction to do that. And we have findings of fact in this case, which probably is unusual. In most cases we look at Anderson, Rhines, Mohler, there are no findings of fact because the jury looked at those cases. And the jury didn't, of course, issue any findings. All we know is the aggravating circumstances that were found to be to be true by the jury.
Yeah.
So how do we balance that? I mean, obviously here we have some findings, but in other cases we don't. Doesn't that tend to indicate to you that our review has to be de novo?
Well, if there are no findings, then there's nothing to give deference to. So I would agree with you that it probably would be de novo. You can't defer to what's not there, but in this case you have findings of fact. At least the findings of fact ought to be entitled to some deference. Now the defense says that, well, there are contradictions, contradictory evidence. That happens every day. That's the nature of the beast. That's why you have a fact finder. Just because there are disagreements doesn't mean that it's wrong and it can't be looked at and it can't be considered and it can't be factored in. But in the normal case, this court, I think, has to look basically at the record and see what is there. Because until it goes in, nobody has. You can't just say there are five aggravating circumstances in this case and three in the other. You can have someone find that five aggravating circumstances being infinitely worse than someone who has six. The number doesn't matter as much as the quality of the actions that are going in here. And while all these people have the same number of aggravating circumstances, there are differences in their actions, in the qualities of their actions.
Aren't we getting off the point, though? Isn't Justice Klonenkamp's question whether or not, because we have an independent obligation to look at the case, we don't give any deference to the findings of fact and conclusions of law, but we look at it de novo? Under the statute?
I don't think the statute really addresses that.
In this, you don't think what?
I don't know that the statute addresses that in a case where you sent it back for reconsideration, the court and the trial court has entered those. I think this would be a somewhat different stance from the normal case where it really just goes through the jury, or the trial court just finds on its own, finds the fact that there's a law. I mean, aggravating circumstances.
I mean, here we have an unusual case because the trial court entered passes death on two individuals, and then after he does that, then the jury on the third co-defendant gives life. And so we send it back for the court to have the opportunity to re-examine that in view of what happened subsequent to what the court did.
Oh, this is also, I think, isn't this the first of the modern death penalty cases where you've had multiple defendants? I mean, it is a different situation. Because normally, you can look at the record, what's happened in it, and compare it somewhat to the proportionality pool. When you have the three that are competing against each other, I think that does make it a slightly different situation. And you have had the trial court who has observed all three. Because that's one thing this court does not have, and it's the nature of an appellate court, is that you don't observe the defendants. You don't observe the witnesses. And for a court that has, they're entitled to deference factually. In the normal case where there aren't any, then this court can look at it on its own, free of...
But isn't that part of the scheme in a death penalty case, is that another body has to look at it without the passion and prejudice that might be involved in being right there in the courtroom at the, and during the entire time?
That's true.
It's our obligation, isn't it, to make sure that the death sentences has uniformity, that it's not imposed regularly in West River and irregularly in East River, that equally guilty people, culpable people get the same sentence.
Uniformity, but I'm not so sure that exact uniformity is required. The U.S. Supreme Court cases have talked a great deal about the fact that there are going to be differences in what the fact finder finds, whether it's the trial court or the jury. It's inherent in the nature in the jury system.
You talk about the Supreme Court's comment, and even you said you were surprised to see that the Supreme Court said that someone who's a more serious offender could receive life and a less serious offender or co-defendant could receive death. That, of course, is an Eighth Amendment analysis, but right. We have a separate analysis, don't we, under our statute?
Yes.
And we don't have to follow the Supreme Court's view that the more serious offender should receive, could, in the court's discretion, receive mercy, whereas the less culpable offender should not.
No, you don't. But then again, when you get into these situations where it's a judgment call, is the judgment of a jury to be so cavalierly treated? Because you look at the decision under Tulaba v. California, under Rinesmuller, the system is that once the aggravating circumstances are found, one of them at least beyond reasonable doubt, it is then up to the unfettered discretion of the jury. That tends to work to the defendant's advantage because they can find him, they can award life for any reason at all. It's not just a completely irrational system that is going to be to the defendant's disadvantage. It actually increases their chance of avoiding the death penalty. I thought there was a question. Now, as for Ring Apprendi, what Ring says is that you have a right to jury trial on anything that raises the penalty, raises your penalty in sentencing. And those are treated as the functional equivalents of elements of a crime. It does not go on to say that those factors have to be charged in an indictment or information. It doesn't. What Ring then says is that our holding today, regarding our holding today, there are only, I don't know whether it's four or six states of the 38 that have the death penalty that have this kind of pure judge deciding system. So that doesn't really affect us, unless, of course, the statutory system that we're looking at does not allow a defendant to plead guilty and have a jury trial. Now, I don't think, as Craig Eichstadt argued earlier, I don't think that's what our statutes say. And I think it's an absurd result to think that our legislature would put in a procedure which has been unconstitutional since 1969. Now, they make much of the defense makes much of the fact, well, there's this last phrase at the bottom of one of the statutes that says that the jury procedure doesn't apply if you plead guilty or or choose a court trial. I agree with Mr. Eichstadt that that can equally be talking about the penalty phase itself. It's not an absolute prohibition, but if it is a prohibition, what is the answer to it? The answer is that if it is unconstitutional, and say it's unconstitutional under Ring and Apprendi, then there's a clear way for the trial court to take care of it. And that's under the statute that says if there's no provision for a procedure, that it can take its own action if it's if it's consistent with the law. Now, what is the law at that point? If it's unconstitutional, then the unconstitutional portions of the statute should be stricken. That's what's normally done. If that last sentence is what's unconstitutional, that can be taken out. And you can substitute in that they do have a right to jury trial. Now, that was done in a case with that's cited in my brief regarding a juvenile prosecution, I think, for abusing a juvenile. And it turned out that I think under the regular rules of criminal procedure, the case could never be charged out because the crime was accepted from the kinds of things that could be tried criminally. So if you read those statutes together, the criminal would go free. You couldn't try him. You couldn't charge him. So what the court did was it fixed it for that situation. And I respectfully submit that could be done here. And in effect, you end up with the same result as what Judge Johnson did. These people did not want a jury trial for whatever reason. They were offered it. They declined it twice. You've got invited error, you've got waiver, you've got no prejudice, and I suggest that they aren't entitled to any relief on that basis. And if there are no questions, I'll sit down.
No, thank you, counsel. Okay, Mr. Murphy, you have 7 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to begin by addressing the issue that Mr. Campbell left with, which is the Ring issue. You know, we have to start with some basic principles. As Mr. Butler said before, shall means shall. I think we can all recognize that a circuit court judge cannot create rights that contravene or exceed this established rights already set forth in statute, and that Ring clearly says that the aggravating circumstances that make a defendant eligible for the death penalty have to be presented to a jury. Now, taking those principles and applying them to the statutory scheme we have in 23A27, we established in the brief a real clear, real concise argument showing the 23A4 and 23A27A6 clearly and unequivocally deny a defendant who pleads guilty in a capital case the right to have a jury sentence him. 23A27A4 says at the last sentence that the procedures for jury sentencing do not apply if you plead guilty. And then you go up two statutes later and it says, the code says very clearly, in a non-jury case, the judge will consider the aggravating circumstances, and he, uses the term he, will determine whether findings of fact exist or factual issues exist to support those.
Is there a rule of law that allows us to interpret that statute so as to make it constitutional?
When the statute says shall, I don't believe that would be within the court's discretion. I don't think we can bend a statute to make it constitutional when the legislature clearly set up the mandates of the statute through the term shall. They said, in this case, if you plead guilty, in these kind of cases, if you plead guilty, you are denied jury sentencing. They didn't say you have to impose the death penalty. So this statute is constitutional.
Option two, then. what the state just suggested before it sat down was to declare that last sentence unconstitutional. How would that affect your client who waived the right to a jury trial?
Well, he didn't waive the right to a jury trial because no such right existed at the time that that whole colloquy occurred with the court. What curing it by striking
He did waive it. He did waive the right to a jury trial. You contend that the court didn't have the right to offer him one, but he did waive whatever. He did waive this illusory offer, if you want to call it that.
Okay. And that, I would say, is substantively different than waiving a right. If it did not exist, if he did not have the right, whatever his actions were, whatever may be labeled as a waiver, was a waiver of nothing. So this problem with striking the last sentence is that the entire process for Mr. Page was infected by a misadvisement of rights. From his arraignment on, he was told he had the unconditional right to a jury to determine his sentence even if he pled guilty. That was certainly the information given to him by Judge Johnson. That was erroneous. That's why we cited the case of Lochelle, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, where in that case, a trial court judge told the defendant he had a right that he did not have. And when that case came before this court, the court said, the trial court judge was wrong. You don't have that right. You're not able to act on it now. And so that's the infection of the process. It's structural, and that infects everything that comes afterwards. Now, the state has said that Mr. Page's case was somewhat different than Timothy Ring's was because he notes that when the Ring was decided, South Dakota was not listed among the states that have pure judge sentencing. Well, I offer to the court that, one, that could be an oversight since they probably didn't become intimately familiar with South Dakota statutes and the subtleties that we're talking about today. But, in fact, when Mr. Page pled guilty, he was in the exact same shoes as Timothy Ring. He had no right at that time under the statutes to have the jury be involved in his determination of sentence. So he was exactly in that procedure, in that same process. Now, going to some other issues that were raised by the Attorney General's office. First, the Attorney General office asked, what is Page looking for in regard to the proportionality issue? We're asking for a meaningful consideration of all the evidence. Asking for an objective assessment of relative culpability based on reliable evidence. That's what we're asking for, and that's what the trial court judge did not do. The trial court judge selectively chose tidbits or snippets of testimony here and there in order to justify his prior sentence. Now, the Attorney General's office said that during the course of the sentencing procedure, the trial court judge only...
2 minutes.
Thank you. Only considered Mr. Page's statements against him. That's incorrect. You look at findings of fact 17 through 20, those come from Hoadley's statement. Those are the statements where that the trial court said Page planned the murder. Page never said that. You look at Elijah Page's change of plea transcript, he consistently said, I didn't plan this, somebody else did. I was just following orders. There's another example of that in regard to the leadership role. Trial court's determination that Mr. Page was a leader would have had to have come from Hoadley's statements, not Mr. Page's. He never cast himself in any way, shape, or form as a leader. So other defendants' statements were used against Mr. Page by the trial court in order to justify the death sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Butler, you have 8 minutes, sir.
SDCL 23A27A-1. In all cases for which the death penalty may be authorized, the judge shall consider or shall include in instructions to the jury for it to consider any mitigating circumstances, and then any of the following delineated aggravating circumstances. SDCL 23A27A-2. In all cases in which the death penalty may be imposed, which are tried by a jury upon a return of a verdict of guilty by the jury, the court shall resume the trial. 23A27A6. In non-jury cases, the judge shall, after conducting the pre-sentencing hearing, If upon a trial by a jury, a person is convicted of a Class A felony, a sentence of death shall not be imposed unless the jury verdict at the pre-sentence hearing includes a finding of at least one aggravating circumstances. Willoughby against Grimm, South Dakota Supreme Court. The words shall and all indicate the legislature intended to create a compulsory obligation. 1997, the South Dakota legislature codified the principle. SDCL 2.14.2.1, the term shall manifests a mandatory directive and does not confer any discretion in carrying out the actions so directed. The state would tell you today that in the manner in which we administer capital punishment, those principles and that law doesn't apply. The state says the Supreme Court has already decided that in the Mueller case, and I suggest to you they did not at all decide it. In fact, the Mueller 2 opinion answered a question never asked. If you go back and you read that decision, what that court does, citing State versus O'Brien, I believe, is claim that the defendants were challenging the discretion of prosecutors. State versus O'Brien was a claim about a discriminatory application of the habitual offender statutes in South Dakota. The court rejected that claim in O'Brien and then relied on it in Mueller. I'm not claiming discrimination in the charging choices they make. It's not the issue. Vague references to the United States Supreme Court upholding the Georgia scheme doesn't answer the question. In fact, their scheme is not identical. You can look at the Georgia statutes. Georgia Unified Supreme Court Rule Number 34 specifies the manner in which prosecutors proceed in death penalty cases. They have to give notice of intent to seek the death penalty in aggravating circumstances at a specified period of time prior to the case going to trial. We have no such procedures. Here, the charging discretion is made when you charge with first-degree murder. Discretion ends when there is a conviction. The procedures then, which are mandated, must be followed for determining the appropriate punishment. I suggest we can't make it up in order to accommodate what we've done. Capital punishment is not a common law thing. It is a statutory creature. We have to look at our own statutes and our own law in deciding whether we're complying with it. And I don't know if Georgia has a law that says when we say shall, we confer no discretion on the parties. It's mandatory.
Mr. Mueller, are you aware of any case in South Dakota where a case has gone to judgment of guilt in a capital case, and then the prosecution has attempted to exercise some discretion by removing the death issue from the judge or jury?
At the point of a jury determination of guilt?
Yeah, after there's been an adjudication.
I can think of one at least that comes to mind, and it was the Eddie McDowell case, I think the T sheriff, where the issue of the death penalty was on the table. A jury was picked, death qualified, and then when Mr. McDowell was convicted, the state declined to go forward and ask for the death penalty. Again, which I would argue they weren't entitled to do. I'm certainly not advocating that everybody should be subjected to the death penalty, but that's the way I contend it's clearly written. What the state should be doing is not here asking you to sanction their discretionary approach to severing the penalty provisions from the statutes and asking the court to follow them when they choose to have them followed. That belongs in the state legislature. Would it be constitutional to have a system where you could sever the penalty provisions and make those also discretionary in the judgment of the prosecution? I suspect so. It could be written that way. It's just not written that way now and hasn't been since 1979. The state suggests that there's something overarching or overreaching about the idea of them being hamstrung in their charging decisions. I'm going to make a general reference now to the federal sentencing guidelines. Prior to their enactment, federal district court judges had the discretion that we frequently confer on judges in state courts. Wide-ranging sentencing choices, consider the factors you consider relevant. Congress took it away. Congress created specific classifications. If you're convicted of this offense, you have so many prior convictions, the weight of the drug is this much. Judge, you sentence in the box. Congress created the box in which the judge has to sentence. We're all familiar, federal district court judges, many of them don't care for that approach. Some prosecutors don't care for it because their discretion is purely in the charging choices they make. But the U.S. Supreme Court has said the legislature can do it. The legislature can take away the control of the prosecutor to bargain penalties. You bargain with your charges, not your penalties. It has told judges you can't sentence outside the box unless there are specific findings made to depart. That's constitutional. It isn't about what we want to do. It isn't about what we'd like to do.
2 minutes.
It's about what we must do and what we have not done and what the consequences of that should be. Not long ago, the United States Supreme Court in Lawrence versus Texas addressed anti-sodomy laws. In a concurring opinion making reference to the equal protection claim at issue there, Justice O'Connor, in citing a previous decision of the court, says, "Nothing opens the door to arbitrary action so effectively as to allow those officials to pick and choose only a few to whom they will apply legislation, and thus to escape the political retribution that might be visited upon them if larger numbers were affected. It is not up to these public officials, prosecutors, to decide who should be subjected to punishment pursuant to a mandatory statutory scheme. It's not written that way. I respectfully ask that this court squarely address that issue in this decision." Finally, I do want to say something with regard, in my short period of time, on the issue of proportionality. Contrary to the representation made, the defense is not standing before the court and saying all uncross-examined statements are inherently unreliable. It's never been said. We are simply pointing out the fact that there are grave concerns with the reliability of some statements. At the penalty hearing regarding Mr. Hoadley's defense, here's what the state said. "But before the defendant is arrested and before he knows there's going to be a consequence for his action, he tells other people about his involvement in the crime. He actually brags to friends about his role in the murder. None of this business that you hear after he gets arrested about, I was forced by Piper and Page to participate, that defense wasn't launched when he was bragging it up to his friends and his buddies. This I was forced defense is just a con, manipulation, it's an attempt to outsmart the jury. Now, Mr. Hoadley was unworthy of belief, according to the state, when the state was asking him to be convicted. And that jury did reject that defense. Now we're told to credit certain things, at least, that he has to say about his diminished role and responsibility as compared to Mr. Piper and Page. I go back to that basic bedrock principle of reliability. If you're going to hold people accountable, at least base it on something you can trust. I suggest to this court the findings of the court below, for the reasons presented here, are not reliable. Therefore, we ask for relief that this court sentence our clients or direct that the sentence of life imprisonment without possibility be imposed on Mr. Page. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Feller. This would conclude the oral presentations of the March term. We would like to thank Dean Vickery, our host, as well as his faculty and his staff. I'd like to thank the South Dakota Highway Patrol for providing security, the monitors, and everybody else who made this a very pleasant experience that we look forward to every year coming down here and holding these oral arguments. With that, we are adjourned.